National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
As a nation faces more political violence, we're all asking the question about how we got here. There's no question that political and cultural polarization and fragmentation is taking a severe toll on the United States. This week on Register Radio, we're joined by Register contributor Alberto Fernandez, who looks at the White House correspondent dinner attack and reflects on the revolutionary vanguards. And then, as we approach the one-year anniversary of Pope Leo XIV's historic election to the papacy, we all continue to be fascinated by his teachings, his travels, and his past. We're joined by Jonathan Liedl, managing editor of The Register, who is also the correspondent for a new documentary on the time the future pope spent in Peru. Hello, I'm Matthew Bunsen, Vice President, Editorial Director of EWTN News and host of Register Radio, joined as always by my co-host, Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Hi, Shannon.
Hello, Matthew.
Well, all of us were shocked at the attack that took place at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I know that we had reporters there who were on the scene, and I know that their reporting really unfolded a moment of chaos, but it is unfortunately nothing particularly new, given the fact that we are living in an age of increasingly violent tribalism. And our guest this week, Ambassador and Register contributor Alberto Fernandez, writes in a new piece, quote, "An attempted attack on the White House Correspondents' Dinner points to a deeper trend. In a polarized West, violence is becoming thinkable again." Ambassador, welcome back to Register Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on with you guys.
Well, we have been having you on a very regular basis over these last few months, talking about the situation in the Middle East, in Lebanon, and of course, in Iran. How are those connected to what we're seeing certainly in the West and this idea of the rise of political violence?
Well, if you want to draw a line between the Middle East and what's happening in the West, there really isn't one, except in this broader way, which is that polarization, extremist narratives, bitter reality on the ground, whether unemployment, inflation, lack of opportunity, all of these things work together to produce volatile populations, especially among the young. This happened. We've seen it forever in the Middle East, and we're seeing it in the West, in the non-Muslim world as well.
Yep. Ambassador, you write about an infatuation with political violence. Obviously, there have been manifestations of actual political violence, but the rhetoric that you're observing, where is that coming from?
Well, I mean, first of all, we have to say we've seen this before sometimes in our own American history. There have been periods 50 years ago, you know, after 1968, in the early 70s, there was a huge wave of the Days of Rage where there was a lot of violence. We forget that. But what you're seeing today, of course, is the world of social media, the indoctrination of higher education, and then, as I said, these kind of physical factors of people's lives, the dead-end lives that people feel. A lot of the violence, most of it today, is coming from the left, but most people believe, and I'm one of them, that it probably won't stay there. It'll become more systemic among both the left and the right. So we're in a very, very volatile situation where violence is seen as necessary. In fact, it's seen as imperative.
Yeah, let's talk just a little bit more about the White House Correspondents' incident, the attack. We still don't know a lot about the suspect who's in custody, Cole Allen, but we do know a little bit about his political views. He's published a manifesto. In some ways, Ambassador, is his storyline, the little that we know, kind of show the progression of how, you know, rhetoric links to action when it comes to political violence?
Absolutely. And the terrifying thing about Cole Allen is that he's not, as far as we know, mentally disturbed. He's not a person on the edge. This is a person who had a good upbringing, a loving family, in fact, a Christian family. and yet was so moved by content that he consumed on social media. In an Islamic context, he's not a Muslim, we would call that he self-radicalized himself. This young man self-radicalized himself. You know, he consumed stuff, and he went from expressing his views on social media to protesting to deciding that violence was necessary, to the extent of taking a train from California to Washington, D.C. to carry out this violence.
Yeah, Ambassador, we saw the reactions to Charlie Kirk's assassination, his murder last year, and it correlates with varying polls and surveys that note that there is an increasing percentage of people who accept political violence, certainly when it occurs to somebody that you don't agree with. Can you talk about how we got here, that we do seem to have these younger generations who are increasingly accepting of violence as a political solution?
Well, I would say there's a kind of a political dimension to it. There is also, of course, I think, a spiritual and ideological dimension to it as well. There's a yawning vacuum in modern life, and people look for things. For some, politics becomes kind of a religion. It becomes the most important thing. You know, Trump is either a horrifying figure or, the plus side, right? Incredibly beloved, rather than saying, this is a politician, I like him, I don't like him, and we've had this before, we will always have this kind of thing. The intensity that we see today, I think, is a result of kind of a vacuum and, acedia that exists among many, especially, I would say, educated, the young, that is very worrying, I think, for our country and for the West in general. It's not going to end well. We're going to see more of it.
When you note that the figure in question here, Cole Allen, a 31-year-old Caltech graduate, as you write, he had moved from social media posting on Blue Sky in protest to traveling across the country to try to commit murder. That, as you write, he was steeped in the online fever swamps of anti-Trumpism. Can we talk a little bit about the role of social media in all of this? Because that strikes me as something that we did not have in previous generations.
Yes, you know, I know this from my work on jihadism, and what we always used to say in the world of studying jihadist radicalization, we would say that social media is not the origin of extremism, it's the accelerant. What it does is it takes a fever or it takes a worldview that already exists, and it ignites it, it heats it up even further. We're seeing this now in a non-jihadist, non-Islamic context, right? We're talking about non-Muslims. But it's the same thing that's happening. It takes a kind of anger or upset or dissatisfaction that already exists. Many people have this, which is, you know, relatively normal. But it makes it into this white heat fire, which is then easily translated into what we call direct action, which is violence, political violence.
Alberto, you write also about the trend lines really not being headed in the right direction. As you said, you anticipate greater polarization, not less. But you also write that the authentic witness of the Catholic Church can be a good counterpoint to what we see going on. The church, maybe more than any other institution on earth right now, has been through and weathered these waves of revolutionary spirit, and can speak to that. But it's a tricky thing. Why so?
Well, the church survived the French Revolution, has survived the persecution of that led to the rise of the Cristeros in Mexico, various communist oppressions. So the church has a lot of experience with persecution, with extremist discourse, especially with extremist political discourse. Since I see this problem as being partially political, also partially economic, but also spiritual, emotional, psychological, cultural, there are few institutions that are able to give responses or find eloquent ways of addressing all of these elements, not just one of them. political, what happens in our hearts, and what happens in all aspects of our lives.
Yeah, well, we started this conversation talking about violence in the world, and we would be doing a disservice to our audience. You are our recognized expert on this. Just to give us an update on where things are with Iran and Lebanon and everything else happening in the Middle East.
Well, that's you need a whole other show. look, with Lebanon, neither one looks very promising. I think we're closer to the end rather than the beginning. On Iran, we're certainly in an end game where there's pressure on Iran and then pressure as a result of Iran on the world economy. The question is, who blinks first, the Iranian regime or the American administration? Iran can't do anything directly to the United States. It's too weak. But it has shown that it can exert power in hurting the world economy, which hurts America indirectly and hurts others directly. So both sides are talking big. Both sides are talking aggressively. It's not clear how this ends, but I do think it will come to some kind of peak in the next few weeks. With Lebanon, it's this basic reality. What do you do with Hezbollah? You know, what can be done? How can it be removed? How can this parasite be removed from the Lebanese body politic without destroying the host, which is the Lebanese people and the Lebanese government? It's the same problem that we've had in Lebanon for decades, actually.
Yeah, and how strong, how durable is the regime at this point? Because we hear about internal divisions among the Iranians and the influence of the Republican Guard.
You know, I'm sure that the regime has these fissures and these internal tensions. But, you know, I'm Cuban-American. I'm used to awful regimes lasting a really long time. And unfortunately, I would like to see the regime implode. I don't think that's going to happen right away. If it does happen, it's going to be later. It's not going to be now. The regime has enough tools of repression and enough ways of surviving American pressure in the short term. So what you could see at the very end is a regime that is actually ferocious and still in power at home and maybe cowed on the international circuit. That's probably the best case scenario in the short run.
Yeah. Well, Ambassador, as always, we will turn to you for the latest, for your analysis on all of that. But thank you for your piece, which you can find at ncregister.com. The title of it is The White House Correspondents' Dinner Attack and the Revolutionary Vanguards. Fascinating conversation.
Thank you.
Well, when we come back, we're joined by Register Managing Editor Jonathan Liedl, who is also the correspondent for a new documentary on Pope Leo and his formative time in Peru. You're listening to Register Radio here on EWTN Radio. Don't go anywhere.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. I'm Matthew Bunsen, Vice President, Editorial Director of EWTN News and host of Register Radio. Here, as always, with Shannon Mullen, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register. Well, it's hard to imagine that it is a year since the election of Pope Leo XIV, but here we are. And as we assess his first 12 months, a new documentary is also providing us a glimpse into his important and formative time as a missionary and bishop in Peru. Register Managing Editor Jonathan Liedl is a correspondent for the new documentary, and he joins us now. And Shannon and Jonathan, this has been a very busy time for you and a time of also great changes.
Yeah, Matthew, you know, in conjunction with the Register's redesign of the print issue, we've been getting a lot of feedback from our readers, and mostly positive. But one of the things they're saying is, hey, we'd like to register more when Jonathan Liedl was writing for you. And so as a programming note, I just want to assure people he is still writing for us. He has been very absorbed in this project that we're going to be talking about today. He's also been promoted from a senior editor and writer to managing editor of the Register. But he's still going to be writing great pieces. So I just wanted to reassure his many fans out there. He's also a new dad. So, yeah, Jonathan, you've got quite a lot going on.
Yeah, just trying to keep all the balls in the air, but obviously grateful and excited for all the opportunities and continuing to advance the Register's mission.
Yeah, how are you finding the transition?
Well, it's great. I mean, I think, writing and editing, it's almost maybe as a sports analogy, like playing and coaching. So, you know, when you step into an editing role and you're working with writers, you try to put yourself back in the shoes when you were writing more and, you know, just trying to think how to be helpful as an editor. And just trying to help continue to guide great stories across the finish line and get them out to our audience.
Mm-hmm.
So, Jonathan, let's talk about this project. This was a big trip late last year and a big logistical and reporting challenge, a linguistic challenge for you. You do more than serviceable job speaking Spanish, but this was a real test. Can you kind of set the scene for our listeners about what you did when you traveled to Peru?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, as we all know, Pope Leo, he's, of course, a native son of Chicago, very much an American, but he spent 19 years down in Peru. And when he was elected Pope, if we think back to his very first moment out on the balcony at St. Peter's, he didn't speak in English, but he gave an address in Spanish talking about his diocese back in Chiclayo, Peru. So, you know, Peru is very important to understanding who he is, you know, how it shaped him and how it continues to, in some ways, guide him as Pope now. So, you know, EWTN News as a whole knew that it was really important to explore that side of Pope Leo. So, yeah, we talked about heading down to Peru as a reporting trip. At first, it might be, you know, a print trip, so writing news articles exclusively. But I think as we thought about it as a whole news organization, you know, the Register part of EWTN News, it became clear that if we're going to have someone go down there, that we really want to capture as much as we can, including those great, video moments, not just interviews on tape, but also going to the places where Pope Leo served, from Chulucanas to Trujillo to Chiclayo, and just trying to give, especially our American audience, a sense of this place and the people that so clearly and deeply shaped our first American Pope. So that was really the idea behind it. So I kind of set off to Peru. You're right, Shannon, I speak some Spanish, but certainly not fluent. So I was aided by a great team of some of our colleagues, our EWTN colleagues down in Peru. And we traveled for, I think, about 9 days across the country. We talked to 22 different people and just a lot of, I think, beautiful, beautiful stories and images that really tell the story of Pope Leo's Peru.
It's very clear that Pope Leo loves Peru, but it's obvious, too, that it's reciprocated. The Peruvians really claim him, don't they?
Absolutely. I mean, that was something that really came through. I learned a great new phrase if anyone wants to work out their Spanish idioms. Someone told me that Pope Leo, this was a religious sister on the street of Chiclayo who I interviewed, she said, Pope Leo es más peruano de la papa, or que la papa, which means he is more Peruvian than the potato. The potato, you know, originated in Peru before it went, you know, over to Europe and Ireland and places like that. But yeah, when he was elected, I mean, the newspapers in places like Chiclayo called him a native pope. They called him a Peruvian pope. He is a Peruvian citizen, which was, you know, a technicality. He needed to have that citizenship to become the Bishop of Chiclayo in 2015. But they completely embrace him as one of their own. And it's not simply because he was the bishop there, but I think it's because he really embraced the culture and the faith of Peru, the very particular and rich devotional life that is in the Catholic Church in Peru. So everything from promoting the Eucharistic miracle at Ciudad Eitan to participating in Señor de los Milagros processions, he really dove into it all. And, you know, one of his colleagues, a priest, Father Jorge Mian, told me that, I mean, Pope Leo really just embraced what St. Paul said when he said that, you know, to be all things to all men, right? That's what a missionary is, bringing the gospel, right? But also connecting with people on their own terms. And I think that really comes through in this documentary.
Jonathan, you follow the Pope very carefully, very closely. What are some of the major takeaways for you? What did you gain insight into in Chiclayo that helps you understand him better as the Pope?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest one is unity, right? This has been a huge theme of his pontificate. He inherited in many ways a very divided church. And, you know, right from the get-go, you know, his first homily or the homily he gave at his the inauguration mass of his pontificate, he said his greatest desire is for a unified church. And he has the papal motto in Illo Uno Unum, which comes from St. Augustine and means in the one Christ we are one. But what I learned is that was his motto as a bishop in Chiclayo, right? So this is nothing new. The unity emphasis is not something that he's just kind of cooking up right now to kind of deal with the problems in the universal church. It's always been how he's viewed the church, how he's viewed the relationship between bishops, priests, and the lay faithful. And, you know, there was some really, a lot of the documentary is very emotional, powerful stories of the people he knew and impacted, but there were also some little nuggets we learned about how he led as bishop, including in some difficult situations. We learned that when he arrived as bishop of Chiclayo, there was actually this really problematic situation that he inherited where there were some former priests, they were cohabitating, they were living with women, but presenting themselves as priests in good standing. And there was a lot of division in the diocese about what to do with that. These men said the church needs to compensate them because they'd given their lives to be priests, while other people were saying they needed to be cut off completely from the church. And Pope Leo, he kind of stepped into that situation and he brought it to a fruitful resolution, really through a kind of more measured approach. He didn't say it's fine if you guys, you know, are living with women and presenting yourself as priests, but he also helped them find jobs, right, so they could transition into the lay state and stop presenting themselves as priests. But I think that kind of, if I can call it principled patience by Pope Leo, it was really a hallmark of his leadership style in Peru, and I think we're going to see that. We've seen it already, and I think we're going to continue to see that in how he leads the universal church, especially through, you know, divisive, difficult, controversial issues right now, whether it's the German Synodal Way or even the Synod on Synodality. That balance between patience, but also principle, commitment to the teachings of the church and to what the church stands for. He doesn't, you know, give in on that. But at the same time, it's not coming in and smacking things down immediately either.
Well, and connected in many ways to the idea of unity is also peace. The very first words out of his mouth as Pope was "Peace be with you." He saw that and in many ways embodied that in Peru in different ways too, didn't he?
Well, during his time in Peru, especially early on in the 80s and the 90s, there was a terrorist group called the Shining Path. This was a Maoist leftist terrorist group. And, you know, Pope Leo was there when they said all foreign priests have to get out. Actually, a Polish missionary priest was killed during that time. And he stayed. He stayed, for over a decade in Trujillo, Peru, during the 90s. But I know this isn't something that was featured in the documentary, but I know that later on when there were sort of reconciliation efforts or attempts at kind of closing that chapter of Peruvian history, Pope Leo, as a bishop in Peru, was very adamant about reconciliatory efforts. So not just ending a conflict, right, but making sure that the causes of it, right, to the extent that there is a just way of dealing with things, that's done, right, to prevent further conflict in the future. So, yeah, I think that's all. It's not just the unity that he seems to be advocating for isn't just a let's all just get along, but like not talk about anything deeper, but ultimately I think rooted in only the peace that Christ can give.
Jonathan, real quick, in the last minute that we have, in the piece that you wrote about the documentary for the Register, you begin by describing sort of an aha moment. What was that?
Yeah, so I mean, I was in Peru for 9 days. I left my pregnant wife behind, and I was really kind of at a certain part of the trip, I was just kind of getting like a little annoyed with it. I'm like, ugh, why am I here? You know, this grumbling about it. And then I realized Pope Leo left his home and came here too, and he came for a lot longer than 9 days. And I'm sure he experienced culture shock in his own way. I'm sure he experienced homesickness, but he willingly and joyfully went, and he went to share the gospel as a missionary. And I think that's really, that moment just helped me realize, like, really who the heart of this man is, and that underneath everything is just the desire to proclaim Christ and share the gospel. And I think that's what he's carrying with him now in Rome as well. And I think hopefully that's what the documentary Pope Leo's Peru helps people see.
Yeah, we recognize him as an Augustinian, but we also treasure the fact that he's arguably the greatest missionary pope in, let's just say, in church history, a very, very long time. Well, Jonathan, as always, a joy to have you on. And for those who would like to catch the documentary, you can still watch it. It's Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern. And you can find it also at EWTN.com on demand. And I encourage everyone to pay attention to this documentary. You'll learn a great deal about Pope Leo. Well, thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
That's it for Register Radio this week. Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. Until next week, on behalf of our producer, Michael McCall, and Shannon Mullen, I'm Matthew Bunsen. Please take care, and God bless.